Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The Roberts Court, that's how the current Supreme Court is going to be known and will be known for generations to come. But will it be seen favorably by history as a body that stood impartially protecting the Constitution or as a partisan tool that falls mainly on the shoulders of Chief Justice John Roberts? Do you think the Roberts Court is partisan and pushing an agenda? Call in your thoughts, comments. Questions, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Our guest is the author of Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution, Lawrence Tribe. And Lawrence teaches the constitutional law at Harvard, and he's argued in front of the high court, including Bush v. Gore. And his name has also popped up occasionally as a possible nominee in the future for the court, also in the past. So, Lawrence, welcome to The Source.
Great to be here.
So is it really unfair to even ask the question that the court could be partisan or not?
It's not at all unfair to ask the question. And I think we're invited to ask it partly because during his confirmation hearings, John Roberts, who, by the way, was a former student of mine, made a big deal of saying he was going to be a neutral umpire, just calling balls and strikes. And I think we all know that it's a lot more complicated than that, and we've got a situation where the court obviously isn't just calling balls and strikes. It's defining the strike zone, it's defining the rules, and lots of people are saying that this is a bunch of politicians in robes. It's not unfair to ask, but one point that's important about my book with Joshua Matz, my co-author, is that it's important to get the answer right. And the answer is it's not just a bunch of politicians, not just a bunch of partisans. Many of the decisions are unanimous, and of those, one out of five since Roberts got to the court that are decided by a very closely divided 5-4 court, a considerable number have sort of unfamiliar bedfellows, with Sotomayor joining with the conservatives on some issues, with Breyer joining with the conservatives on other issues, with Alito and Scalia at one another's throats on all kinds of questions. What's really important isn't just nose counting, but figuring out what the underlying reasoning of the court is. That's the only way we can get a sense of where they're going to move in the future. And even when the court is 9-0, it turns out that there are often separate opinions expressing different views, pointing in quite different directions. And I think when you look at it that way, both it's a lot more interesting. You don't get this cardboard cutout image of the justices that makes them look like they are simply clones or robots. And you get a lot more insight into where the court is going.
Are the justices, are they really concerned with only the law? Like, what does the law do? Or are they looking at the impact of their decisions?
It's not an either or. When you're talking about the Supreme Court, the law is not something that exists out there in the stratosphere for them to discover. The law is something that they help to create. It's a complicated process in which words like liberty and equal protection don't have a single, universally agreed upon meaning. So, of course, judges and justices with different life experiences, different visions of the world, different ideas about what the Constitution is for, will have different ideas of what the law is. It is the function of the court to determine the law, but the idea that the law is something that's out there, that's already been decided, and that all you need is clever technicians to apply it, is just a complete misunderstanding of what the court does.
But could they? Do they weigh if they could? It seems like they can come up with any reasoning to get to a point where that they want to achieve.
That's a common fallacy. Not any reasoning. There are many cases where justices end up voting in ways that, you know, make them hold their nose or avoid gagging because they end up voting for flag burners in the name of the First Amendment. When they hate flag burning, they end up voting for funeral protest.
But that was not a Roberts Court decision, the flag burn.
No, but I mean, even now in the Roberts Court, for example, when a bunch of bigots protested at the funeral of a dead soldier and said, God hates fags, God hates the United States because it lets gays and lesbians into the military. Everybody except Justice Alito decided that that was protected by the First Amendment. Now, I think there's a lot to be said for the Alito dissent, but you can't say that that people like Roberts or Thomas or Scalia voted for the right of those characters to protest because they agreed that God hates the United States. It's a lot more complicated.
All right, our phone lines are open. We want to get callers in on the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. What's your take on the Roberts Court? Do you think they have an agenda? Do you think he is just an impartial umpire? Let's get Bennett on the line. Bennett, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Mr. Davies, I think it may be erroneous to call the present court a Roberts Court. I think it may be more germane to call it a Bush family court, because Justices Alito, Scalia, Thomas, and Roberts have been appointed by one of the two Bush presidents. And their ideology and their thinking is pretty much consistent with a very, oligarchical viewpoint of how the United States should be governed.
All right, Bennett, thanks for that call. We appreciate those comments. But Lawrence Tribe, the Bush father and son may have appointed these folks, but they're appointed for life. They can do anything they want now.
Well, I think Bennett makes an interesting point when he calls it the Bush family court. But Alito and Scalia have disagreed dramatically on a lot of cases about privacy. Very often, Alito and Breyer have agreed to restrict privacy when Scalia has been defensive of the privacy of individuals in a lot of cases. There are also cases where Sotomayor joins with Roberts and Thomas and Alito and Scalia, too, to create a 5-4 majority in support of what I would regard as pretty conservative results, results that make it harder for the government to control drug prices. So we have, it's true that Bennett is right, that when the political process puts conservatives in office, they are likely to appoint generally conservative justices. Elections have consequences. That's an important lesson. But it's also important not to overstate the consequences and to assume that these justices who serve for life and ultimately don't owe anything to the people or the political parties who got them there are simply doing the bidding of the ideological wing that put them in power.
And did the Roberts Court also ruled against Bush and the White House about Gitmo and things like that?
Yeah, they definitely said that the president doesn't have a kind of blank check to do whatever he wants just because we're in war, although I have to say it's important to note that O'Connor wrote the main opinion in that case and that Roberts dissented.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation talking about the Roberts Court and the Constitution. Are we changing what we thought we knew about the Constitution based upon what John Roberts thinks the Constitution actually is and where that is taking us? We want your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. We're speaking with Lawrence Tribe. He's a constitutional professor over at Harvard University and has written the book Uncertain Justice. This is the Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Only about a third of Americans believe the Supreme Court decides its cases based on the law alone. That's according to new polling data about the court. According to the new poll, Americans believe the Supreme Court justices are political, letting their personal views sway their decisions. And that's an opinion held across party lines. And more than three quarters of Americans opposed the Citizens United ruling. And that's after the Supreme Court handed that landmark decision about campaign finance decisions. That goes against the what's being written by Lawrence Tribe in the book Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. And Lawrence, you're saying that the court really is not a political body, that it is not partisan, right?
Well, I'm saying it's not partisan. I would not say that it isn't political, because law and politics are joined at the hip when it comes to constitutional law. When you're trying to decide how to balance free speech against the values of reproductive freedom in cases like the one that is now pending in the court dealing with a 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics, or how to balance the dangers of giving government the power to orchestrate the sounds of speech and decide who is speaking too loudly or with too much backing, balance that against the importance of having our democracy not so dependent on money. Those are inherently politically charged issues. They're certainly legal issues because they deal with the meaning of the law of the Constitution. But people who expect the court to come to the Marble Palace without any personal views about how things hang together and what makes sense, and to set those views aside and simply act as though the law were some, you know, objective thing way out there in the stratosphere, just don't understand the way constitutional law works. That's why we have a political process for appointing justices. We have an elected president nominate them. We have an elected Senate decide whether to confirm them. It's precisely because their philosophy of life and of the way life relates to law is bound to determine and strongly influence how they tilt in these close cases.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines. Andrew has called in. Andrew, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, David. Yes, to answer your question, I believe that the current Supreme Court is very biased towards corporations. One, with the Citizens United pretty much allowing anybody, including super PACs and regular PACs, to make almost unlimited contributions to campaigns. And with the McCutcheon deal that just went through, that even further removes caps on campaign contributions. So pretty much money is speech right now, and those with the most money can speak the loudest. And that is incredibly unfair to the majority of Americans. And right now our poverty level is
okay.
Somewhere, yeah.
Okay, Andrew, we got your point. So Lawrence Tribe, is the court tilted towards corporations?
Well, I'm afraid the Constitution, as it was written long ago, is tilted not so much toward corporations, but toward power. And power is often expressed in the form of wealth. The Citizens United decision protected not just the rights of corporations, and by the way, it could be right-wing or left-wing corporations, but also the rights of unions, and also the rights of wealthy individuals, whether they are the Koch brothers or George Soros. And although I personally am very troubled by the role of money in politics, I don't think we would get very far by thinking that the Supreme Court is doing what it's doing because of a Republican agenda. If Citizens United, which was an anti-Hillary Clinton film, had instead been an anti-Romney film or an anti-McCain film, the decision would have been exactly the same. And I think it's because the justices have a strong view that it's dangerous to give to government, to elected officials, who, if Andrew is right, are bought and paid for already by corporate wealth, very dangerous to give them the power to design a campaign finance system, which is likely to keep them in power, without the court intervening to say, well, wait a minute, whenever the government decides who's speaking too much and who isn't speaking enough, that in itself violates First Amendment principles.
Well, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole with Citizens United, but I mean, I've heard people say that Malcolm Stewart, who was he's the one who botched it. And if he had done a better job, we would not have ended up with Citizens United.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, identifying particular individuals who did or didn't do a good enough job doesn't get to the point. The point is the Supreme Court, ever since the 1970s, and it's not new with Citizens United or with the Roberts Court, has taken the view that because speech is protected and not particular speakers, regardless of who the speaker is.
Yeah, but the case that was brought, the original question of Citizens United was very narrow in whether or not and it was greatly broadened by the court under John Roberts. He saw the opening with Citizens United and turned it into something much more than the original Ted Olson argument.
No, that's right. And one reason that Ted Olson has strongly endorsed my book is that he thinks I did a fair job of describing both how John Roberts went quite far in expanding the issue and in describing what the pros and cons of the various arguments are. I'm not sympathetic to the conservatives on the court. I'm a liberal myself. But I think just, preaching to the choir and joining one another in battering down the heads of the five more conservative justices might be a way of making us feel good, but it's not a way of understanding what's going on or of improving things.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Bob has called in. Let's get Bob on the air. Hey, Bob, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David. Professor Tribe, good to hear both of you. I'm wondering if, Professor Tribe, if you would view the Earl Warren Court as being similarly ideologically agnostic. I'll take my answer off the air with it. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Sure. Well, my answer to Bob is I don't view the court as being ideologically agnostic. I've said several times, and I mean it, that law and ideology are merged when it comes to constitutional law. I'm saying they are not tilted toward one political party or another. They are not deciding cases in order to strengthen the Republicans or the Democrats, but these people come to the court with strong ideological views about the meaning of liberty and the role of money in politics. And it's naive to expect them to kind of surgically remove those views from the legal questions that come before them. Earl Warren Court obviously was much more liberal, vastly more liberal than this court. And its decisions were ones with which I sympathized a lot more. I worry that the current court would not have decided Brown v. Board of Education the way the Warren Court did. But it's not because the Warren Court was not an activist court or not an ideologically committed court. They had to overrule an important precedent to decide Brown v. Board. And, of course, the country was divided on that issue as it is divided on many issues today.
So your book, Uncertain Justice, really looks at the nuances of the court and some of the different political alliances that will pop up from case to case. But we see in the popular media sort of a right versus left sketch, cartoon of what the court is like. And that, I think, sort of powers these polling numbers that we're seeing, where only a third of Americans believe that the Supreme Court decides cases based on the law alone. So do you think that the media is failing in the way that it reports on the Supreme Court?
It's not so much a media failure, because when you've got a 24/7 news cycle and instantaneous stuff on the internet, there's only so much that a quick news report can give people. But that's why I thought it was important to write this book. The book has got all kinds of funny stuff in it about baseball, about the way the justices sort of mock one another. There are all kinds of humorous stories, and I put them there because I think it's important for a careful analysis of what's really going on, not to be boring, not to be painful to read. But my hope is to push against the tide. The media reports leave people with an impression that is necessarily what a snapshot provides. And I'm trying to provide something, that a kind of motion picture of what the court is doing will more satisfyingly provide.
So you mentioned the 24-hour news cycle, but that's also a 24-hour news hole that has to be filled. So there's plenty of time to actually do the accurate and nuanced reporting that I think that people would benefit from.
Well, I know, and occasionally when I listen to Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert, I begin my chapter on Citizens United with all of the hilarious stuff that Stephen Colbert did with his super PAC of his own. But when I look at that, I realize that there are opportunities for the media to provide deeper coverage when they're carefully, couched in a way that people can swallow and enjoy. So I'm not, I don't mean to exonerate the media entirely. I think people could do a somewhat better job.
We've seen presidential candidates run against the Supreme Court before. I'm thinking of FDR. You think that could happen again with people so unhappy with Citizens United and corporate personhood?
Well, I suppose it's possible, but I think if the Republican, you know, I mean, the fact is that both parties disagree largely with Citizens United. There was a powerful pushback from President Obama on Citizens United when Justice Alito mouthed the words not true in the State of the Union message. It's hard to make it into a partisan issue because both sides seem to agree that the court went too far.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lawrence Tribe. He is the author of Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. He's also a constitutional law professor at Harvard University. He's been there for four decades, written widely about the law. He's also argued dozens of cases before the court, and including Bush v. Gore. And thank you so much for joining us, Lawrence.
My pleasure, David.
And this is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.